Hey, it's Bootstrapped Web Friday, the couple days before we head out to Vegas for MicroConf. Jordan, I'll see you in a couple days, buddy, but what is going on today?
I am excited. I'm excited, man. This, like, every year, you know, the energy level just gets, it all leads up, and I love all the stuff that happens before, setting up the dinners and talking to people. And, you know, it's like the conversations on Twitter and DM get better because you're going to see the people in like a few weeks. So that's exciting.
I love like the tradition of it all. It's not like, I don't even think of it like going to a conference. It's going, this is where I go every year in March or April to Vegas. Like this happens every time, seeing all these people. I can't wait, man.
Yes. And if I'm honest, I love the little scheming that goes on before it. I don't know if anyone else does it. I think maybe it's, I don't know if it's just me. I'm sure.
What kind of scheming are we talking about?
Okay. So here's an example. you've been to MicroConf before. If you notice, the past few years, Carthook comes up in the presentations. So it's like a little bit accidental, but it's not entirely accidental. So things like that, people will reach out to me and say, hey, can I use your tweet in the presentation? And so instead of just saying yes, I give out like a few paragraphs of my thoughts behind it. So it just gives that person as much ammo as possible to talk about us as much as possible. Like these little things that I just get so much satisfaction from.
Of course, exposure.
I don't care if it's cynical or what. It's so much fun.
I used to do the attendee talks. I spoke at MicroConf Europe 1 year. But in recent years, I'm less interested in that kind of stuff. I love doing the podcast and stuff, and I love talking to people in the hallways. But like this year, I didn't do the attendee talk thing, and I'm just excited to go and see people for a week. It's just like the Big Snow Tiny Comp stuff, where it's like I don't like making a ton of time while I'm home for meetups, for coffees, for even just calls just to catch up with friends. Like I don't do that a whole lot. It happens a lot in Slack and stuff, but it's the trips to Big Snow Tiny Comp or to MicroConf where it's like both relaxation and business catch-up friendship kind of stuff all mixed into 1 week, where I'm planning on not caring about work for a whole week so I could just focus on the catching up with people. So yeah,
I'd say for me it's a bit different, where those meetings, those calls, the Zoom calls, in-person meetings, that's my favorite thing to do, and my calendar is more and more full of that. I don't care if people think it's inefficient. That's what I'm best at, so that's what I do more of. And so MicroConf is like an intense few days of that all day, every day for 3 days. Yeah, I'm excited to meet some new people. The Tiny Seed Mentor event I'm really excited for. You will see Carthook up on a few presentations. That's always like a little bit of a thrill. And I also don't have the pressure of the talk from last year. So I'm much more relaxed going in.
Yeah, totally. And of course, I just got a text this morning that my flight home has been canceled through Southwest, thanks to the Boeing 737 fiasco. So that's always fun. Got that. I got it rebooked, but I'll have to wake up like 2 hours earlier on Wednesday after the Tuesday night party. So, yes. That'll be fun.
Yeah, a little bit of a pain. And generally speaking, I go into MicroConf excited to see people. But yesterday, somebody asked me if I could meet at 11:15 on Monday. So that made me go to the schedule, to the site.
I'll be honest, I hate that.
You hate
like
what?
I know it's your thing. I hate going to conferences and having appointments. I just don't do it. I don't make appointments.
Good for you. I have a note, an Apple note in my phone that just says all the people that I want to meet and I want to make sure I spend time with while I'm there. It ends up being scheduled.
When it's important to me, of course, I'll make time for a call with someone. I like scheduling that on Calendly for like next week, like after MicroConf or whenever. But like if I'm going somewhere, like especially somewhere like MicroConf, where it is just so unpredictable hour to hour, like where I'm going to be or where I'm going to want to be, I just like to keep it unpredictable, with like dinners being the exception. Like we have some reservations and stuff like that. But like middle of the day, I don't know if I want to step into a talk or talk to somebody over here or go get lunch over there. Like I just don't know. So I don't want to like give anybody a commitment.
Yeah, I feel like I want the commitment from other people too, because there definitely have been a few years where I really wanted to spend half an hour talking to someone to catch up with them and to ask them specific things to talk about. And then the few days go by and it just didn't happen. So I like try to minimize the regret. But that request for a meeting made me look at the site, which I hadn't been to in a long time. And I'm really excited about the topics and the speakers.
Yeah. So I'm looking at that now. I'm sort of just looking at it for the first time. The one that I'm excited about, probably everyone else, is hearing Jason Fried and seeing him in person for the first time. So that would be pretty cool.
I saw him in person in New York, and I still remember the comment he made to me. I'm sure he doesn't remember, but it was just after one of their books came out, and I asked a question from the audience, and he gave me like a very backhanded comment that did not feel good to get, but was also the truth, which sounds exactly like
I think Jason Fried and DHH only do backhand comments.
So. Yes, like perfectly on brand. It was basically like, here's why I'm better at making money than you are. It's because I've had, I'm not kidding. This is the answer. It's because I've had more practice, and making money is something you get better at, and I've had more practice than you. And I was like, well, fuck you, man.
I feel like talks and articles and like ideas and tweets from Jason Fried and DHH are kind of like, they're kind of like songs that you can like pull up at any time. Like just these like common repetitive like refrains of like practicing making money, or, you know, doing slow meetings, or, you know, working remotely, and like just so many nuggets over the years. I know I'm not alone here, but like, you know, that sit down with Rob and some guest every year where he does basically an onstage interview, that's always one of my favorite talks by far.
When he did that with Jason Cohen one year, it was really, really good.
Yeah, and the one with Patrick Collison.
That's right. That was really good. Yeah, 37 Signals is the important, unattainable ideal that it puts a flag in the ground that says, this is possible. You probably won't attain it because it's just an unlikely thing to attain because it's unique and it's an outlier, to say the least. But it's important that it exists as an example that you can do things remote. You can do things calmly. You can say no to customers. All these things that now are common knowledge. They're common wisdom. We talk about it like, oh, everyone knows that's how you should be thinking. But they really help. They help pave the way for that. So it's exciting.
Yeah. So who else are you looking forward to?
Anyone that mentions Garhook. No, just kidding.
Right.
I don't remember what I saw. I saw a lot of topics that felt very relevant. One of them was about being customer centric.
Yeah. I'm looking at the list here.
If I look over the past 4 or 5 years, I remember at the very beginning, I wanted to learn more about how to get things started. Then I wanted to learn things about how to grow. And now I want to learn things about how to manage. So it's like an arc, right? Depends what angle you're coming from and what stage your business is at, that's the new knowledge that you need to know.
I'm excited to catch up with Patrick Campbell and ask him about pricing. I'm sure like 1,000 people are going to ask him about pricing, but that's just something that's on my mind. And something I'll give an update again from last week on what I'm thinking about pricing with Process Kit. Chris Savage from Wistia, I have not seen him talk before, and been a fan of Wistia for many years, so that's pretty cool. There's always one or two speakers that I've never heard of before that are like my favorite talks of the week. So I'm always looking forward to finding out who that's going to be.
Yep, exactly right. And it's going to be, and some of the attendee talks are fun, so that's good, man.
Yeah.
So what else is going on this week, my man?
I don't have a whole lot new from last week, but I guess I'll just sort of give an update on what I was talking about last week, which was pricing for Process Kit. I still don't fully know what the answer is yet, but I think I have a little bit of a clearer direction on it because I've been sort of mulling it over the past week. And I just got off another customer research call this morning with a guy who sounded very promising about where I was headed with the pricing. So I'm almost certain I will not be doing a free plan. Just not a good idea right now. There will be a free trial of some kind. I don't know what the length would be. My starting point, I would probably guess, would be 14 days, and we'll see if I need to extend it from there. I had two sort of options that I was kicking around this week in terms of what the price points will be. There's option A and option B. Option A is having two levels, two tiers, both per user pricing. having like what I was going to call a standard plan of like $15 per user per month, and then a plus plan for like around $30 a user per month, and then putting, you know, more valuable features in the upper tier. The other thing being there would having like a 2 or 3 person minimum. You have to pay for 3 seats and up.
Right. So there's a base.
Yeah. I'm leaning towards option 2 or option B here, which is just have a single plan and all features are in the same plan. And it's going to start probably around $50 a month. That's like the base plan. And you get up to 3 seats included in that. And then after that, it's like $20 a month per seat.
So that's very similar to the $15 per user, but minimum of 3s. Something, there are positives to both. I like the establishment of the product as specifically for teams. I think that will point you in the right direction.
I don't want a lot of solo people paying next to nothing for it. I do talk to a lot of people who are one person and they have a couple of contractors, or like they're a partnership of like 2 or 3 people, you know, and then they have some contractors and stuff. And I think it could benefit them at the $50 a month level. But then I think the majority of users would be above 3 people. Like the person I spoke to this morning has 15 people on his team, and he's currently paying for 3 or 4 different tools, about $100 a month each. And he's literally looking at Process Kit as like, this replaces like probably 3 of those. I laid out that pricing that I just laid out now. And he was like, that sounds totally reasonable. I mean, just considering the fact that like it seems to replace these tools, like I would happily pay around $300 a month for my team to use this.
Yeah. That's the right type of customer. And if you look at launch as the beginning of the real development of the product, like, okay, you put out an MVP, or maybe it's more than an MVP, but it is a starting point. And based on that first cohort of users, the first 3 to 6 months, that's going to point you in a direction on where the product's going to go.
Yeah. Because those first users start to refer
yes,
other users.
And that's yeah. who you start to build for. So if it's teams that jump on board, then it's much more likely that the future of the product is aimed toward teams and larger average revenue per user and more value. And that is my worry about getting individual people in, not because it's a bad thing, but it will point you in a different direction.
Yeah. This comes up in every single call that I do, and I'm doing about 1 or 2 of these a week now, especially if you're running an agency, like a marketing agency or a web design agency. They are gluing together 2 or 3 tools for this purpose. And it's sort of a mess. And we do it too in audience ops. We're literally doing that too. Like he was describing that, like for every project, we make a checklist in Asana. And then, but in order to keep that in sync with our documented processes over in this other tool, we have to keep a Google Doc in the middle of them to be like our central source of truth that links to the ID of the project.
And yes.
And like we use Zapier to sort of make them talk to each other, but it doesn't always work. And I'm like,
perfect.
You know, like that is the space that I'm trying to glue into a single tool, you know?
Right. So hearing that and working with someone like that, working with a few dozen like that, it starts to infuse everything, not just the tool and the features, but the marketing and the value proposition and the pricing and what it says on the marketing site. So that's beautiful. That's very exciting to hear.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, I'll kick it back over to you now.
Cool. So the big theme for us is that it feels like the plateau of January after the holidays is starting to break. So we were in it for roughly 2.5 months. And then over the past 2 weeks, revenue unlocked again. And so we're up a little over 10% in revenue since January 1. So it kind of stayed relatively low and was bouncing around flat for 2 months. And then March it went up. And then the past few weeks it finally ticked up. So it feels very much like the plateau broke.
Anything you can point to? Because I know you were working a lot on the churn stuff. Would that impact revenue at this point?
Not really. You know, what we were doing on the churn front, other than just continuing to improve the product and try to bring the right people into the process, but we were proactively canceling accounts. And that's been an interesting thing in and of itself, but that really wouldn't make the revenue go up. It makes the churn number go down and it makes support load go down, but not really revenue. Revenue, the only thing that really makes that go up is the customers being successful. And so it goes directly alongside the processed revenue. So we're on track to process 45 million this month in March, which matches our highest point during the holidays in November.
When you see this increase in revenue, can you point to it being like that is expansion revenue or that is customer growth revenue?
It's both right now. It's both. So the payment processing is expansion revenue, right? It's a customer that paid us $1,000 last month is going to pay us $2,000 this month type of thing.
Right. But I mean like the bulk of that 10% increase, is it from expansion?
No, the bulk of it is new customers.
Yeah.
Yep. And the truth is we don't count the increase in expansion revenue until next month when it's confirmed that Stripe is going to send us a fatter check. So I mark that in the MRR next month, but it's really for the processed revenue for this month. So I'm not counting that. With that counting it, then the revenue's gone up more than 10%. But in our attempts to focus on customer KPIs ahead of company KPIs, that's been a big thing over the past 2 weeks, where we're saying to ourselves, we don't want to talk about our KPIs first. When we get together in our meetings, we get together in all hands meeting, the stats that we send out, we shouldn't talk about MRR churn. We should be talking about processed revenue, average order value, average conversion rate on checkout page, all these things that are customer centric, because they are actually the leading indicators and MRR and churn are the lagging indicators. So we've tried to focus more and more on the customer KPIs as the indicator of how we're doing, instead of looking at the things that lag behind about a month or so, because it's not as accurate and it also feels better and feels more right to be more customer centric in that way.
You know, you have the type of product that's just so, it's just numbers, man. You could just literally look at revenue processed, you know, or
yes,
sales processed and,
yes,
and point customers to say like, look how much money we made you.
Right. So the real life example of it, if I look at MRR right now, I'd say, okay, we're doing a little bit better. But if I look at actual transactions, meaning how our customers doing, we are back at the highest level we've ever been. So we are back. So November 2018 was our highest month ever at 46 million. And so this month we're on track to do 45 million, which tells me we have recovered from the peak of the holidays, then going down in January. And then only 3 months later in March, we're back to the same level. And that gives me a much better idea on how we're doing compared to what's the MRR like, because that's lagging. That part of it feels good in terms of I was worried that the plateau was going to be, you know, 6 months or so. And we were trying to make sure it's not a 6 month thing.
Yeah. I mean, these things just go in waves, man. Like you can't really predict them unless you're really like pushing something new. Like, I mean, on the marketing front, was something like driving more leads?
No, a little bit of that, but I don't think that's the dominant force. I think the dominant force is the market overall, which is, okay, the fourth quarter, people don't sign up for things because they're just holding still for the holidays and all those promotions. Then January, everyone catches their breath. And then all of a sudden, people are more ambitious. They're looking for new tools. And then it makes sense. In March, all of a sudden, our transaction revenue and along with our customers is starting to go up because now there's a renewed focus on new tools, new attempts, getting things set up, things that are on your to-do list. So I think that is driving more of it than our marketing efforts.
Yep. Yeah. One of the other things that is on my mind right now with Process Kit, I'm asking customers about this. I had a good talk about it this morning, is onboarding and getting them to switch into it and getting them committed to it. Like, I think that's going to be probably the biggest challenge with selling this product, you know,
inertia of what people are already doing.
Yeah. You can be totally bought into how much value Process Kit would deliver and how much of a fit it is for your team. But the reality of it is if you're a company like the company I spoke to this morning, like I was like, what will that look like for you to make the switch? And he was like, it's at least 50 man hours of just copying our processes over and getting all set up and reworking our Zaps and getting our team on board with it. And I'm going to need a few weeks to try it out just to make sure it's right. And meanwhile, I'm still paying a few hundred a month for these other tools because I'm not going to shut them down right away. It's just like migrating an email marketing tool, to be honest. I spent about that many hours, you know, going to ConvertKit, and it's going to be a huge barrier. And I've got to figure out, I'm going to need to navigate it. I think every company is going to be a little bit different. Like, some already have a lot of entrenched systems and messiness. And like, they've been using a bunch of tools. They are using systems and processes, but it's kind of a mess and those tools don't talk to each other and stuff like that. And they need to refigure all that out. And then there's going to be other companies who probably need more of a consulting of like, we need better processes, you know.
What are you thinking in terms of how involved you'll be in helping people make that transition?
I mean, I don't know.
This is where average revenue per user starts to have a say on how much time you can commit.
The way that I would attack that problem, I think, is, I mean, maybe offer like a paid consulting, like a 1 month consulting thing for like $1,000 or more to get them committed to that. And through the process of consulting with them on their systems and processes, not only are me and my team sort of doing a lot of that legwork for you, but we're going to train your team on it and we're going to get you all set up in your ProcessKit account. And by the end of the month, you're good to go. And they pay for it, so they're committed to it. That's sort of where my thinking would go with that.
When people tweet about moving from one email provider to another, let's just say from Drip to ConvertKit, right? We've seen that a few times on Twitter. One of the things people talk about in that transition is the slight nuanced differences where you have to change your mindset on how you think about a list or a subscriber or a campaign. And that sounds like part of the process also for ProcessKit is doing things, even if it's slightly different, requires some work and thinking and a change of mindset.
You know, one of the things I don't love about ConvertKit, in my experience, this is not for, I'm not making a recommendation for anyone else. And like, I'm a customer of ConvertKit now. I have a list that's significant and a lot of automation that is very significant to migrate in, going from Drip to ConvertKit, right? At my price level, whatever, they offer a done for you free concierge migration service. I don't want any part of that. I want to do the migration because I set up all the automations. I need to know exactly how my automations work in my new ConvertKit account. With my level of sophistication in the automations and my list size, not only is it a big job, it's like a high risk job.
Yeah, it's a lot of risk.
Because I did accidentally send an email to all these people that I did not want to send an email to during that process because something screwed up. And something works a little bit differently in ConvertKit than it does over there. And what I need during that onboarding process is like fast, efficient, and like expert level customer support. Like while I do it myself, I need you there to be ready to answer my pretty technical questions, on how the product works. You know, and I'm not going to be like a super needy customer forever, but for the 2 weeks that I'm working on the migration, yeah, like I need answers, you know.
Yeah, and it's intense and it's high stakes. It's tens of thousands of dollars at your fingertips with every little feature and every nuance.
Ultimately, when things sort of went wrong, I got on a call with one of the engineers at ConvertKit. They were nice enough to put somebody of that level in touch with me because I was like, man, like I got to think that I'm not the only person who has run into this issue that caused the misfire of the email. It wasn't like an honest mistake. I was like, I literally did not expect it to work that way. And I was like, are other people running into this like all the time? And he was like, well, we actually just at this level, we always do the concierge migration. And I'm like, I just don't understand that either. Like how is it that like I'm not just going to hand over my whole account. I don't mean to make this all about ConvertKit, but
it's an interesting process.
I think the point that I'm making is that like, I think a lot of people talk about this idea of concierge migrations or customer success or things like that, where it's like, let us do the work of setting you up and making you a paying customer. And you don't have to do a thing. You can just sit over there while we set up your account. Like, no, You got to have the person and their team totally bought into it and trained on making this part of their operation if they're going to stick around for a long time. You know, it sort of depends on the tool, but like,
yes. You know. But I totally understand your point of view, and I completely sympathize with what ConvertKit's trying to do internally. You have to set your team up with a roadmap of how onboarding should go. If you just say you need to be fully flexible for every single person and get their custom set up every single time exactly how they want it, you will lose your mind and your employees will lose their mind. So that's a big challenge. It makes me think of YNAB, right? You need a budget. That tool is not just a budgeting tool. It is a different way of doing budgeting. So those tools that ask you to do both are challenging in the initial onboard, but really powerful once you get bought in, which is why YNAB and their founder going out and talking and really getting people to buy into their mindset and their way of doing things is hugely important.
Yeah. I mean, I know that there are probably SaaS founders out there who have huge customer bases, and they're probably listening to this being like, Brian, you're out of your mind. Like, this is, there's no way we could support that sort of thing. But I think one solution to this that I would hopefully explore something like this if my company ever got to this level, you have your tier one customer support, and they're just there to answer everybody's questions on live chat or email support, and they close out tickets just like every other SaaS. But if you're charging $150 a month or more for the product, or you have people in that tier or above, there's some smaller segment of that tier who is more technical and they're power users and they need help during onboarding. I think you should reserve experts at the company, whether they're engineers or customer success people who are like more senior, to just be there to answer questions. And I don't mean on call 24 hours a day. I mean, like, even if I have to book the call on Calendly,
for
24 hours from now to get 20 minutes with an expert to get my answers to questions, like that's fine, you know, but like that thing needs to be available in getting like customers onboarded to these, especially when it's like a big operational SaaS that's like key to your operation, you know?
Yes, if it's mission critical. So this is a good transition into the next thing I want to talk about, because it's directly related to this. We recently changed the title of one of our positions. It used to be called a technical support engineer, which effectively said, this is someone in support that was technical, right? This is, okay, things that our support specialists can't answer because it's too technical, let's have someone on the support team who's an engineer. We have since, over the past few weeks, changed the title, and not just the title, but the actual role. We've moved it out of the support department, and it's now a customer engineer. It is an engineer that helps customers get onboarded and have their problem solved and achieve what they want to achieve, which is more than support. They help with the support team, and the support team looks to them for technical help, but they float out on their own much more. So success and biz dev bring them into demos and bring them into conversations and bring them into onboarding.
To sort of like answer questions about like integrating with the customer's system over there and like things like that.
It's just a deeper level of need, like what you're saying. Like when we get merchants, our favorite merchants, our best merchants are really sophisticated, and they're doing millions of dollars a month in revenue. Every day is hundreds of thousands of dollars in revenue, and they don't want to mess around. They're cautious.
It doesn't seem like it's that far-fetched, or that it's that impossible to do that. Like, I think, I feel like a lot of companies just don't do it because they're like, well, we can't make people available. Like, it's just not scalable. But I've got to think that it's a very small minority of those customers that are like more technical power users. So just give them that support. If you're going to make your product technical, then there's going to be some power users on it, you know?
Here's the actual topic I want to bring up, right? Here's how it's related. We want to do that as much as possible, but we want to do it for the best merchants. So if you have the potential to be $2,000 a month in revenue, we want to make sure that you get that help. And at that level, it is clearly worth it. So we want to do it. Our challenge is right now we still have a self-serve signup, right? We've talked about the experiment in changing the sales process. That's going to take a while. It's going to take a month. So in the meantime, right now, we're looking at our situation and we're talking to our support team. And what we're gathering is somewhere around 50%, an enormous, enormous amount, 50% of the support team's time is spent on trialing customers that will not become good customers. They might pay once, so they might even convert, and the support team is helping them convert, but they're not going to stay on for a long time. And so they'll drop off within a month or two, and we know that from the very beginning. So they sign up, they'll ping support, they ask a question. We look at their persona. We look at the details that make up their entire picture, right? From how much they process to what they're selling to how they're selling it to all that. And we can tell right away, not going to be a good customer. So now my question to you is, how do you tell that person to take a walk without being a dick? How do you say our support team has decided that you are not worth our time and effort, so we suggest you use this other product that's better for you? Please cancel your trial right now and go away. Like, that is actually what we want to say, but you can't say that.
I mean, you're saying you would want to say that when that customer comes to you with a time-consuming request.
Exactly right. Hey, it's not working with my theme. Can you take a look? And that's, you know, an hour of looking at theme and apps and interactions between our app and this other thing. Before any work is done, we know they're a bad customer. We know they're not right for us. They shouldn't pay us $300 a month. They're not going to get the value from the product.
I mean, something like that, like, especially if it's a common question, I know it won't be a common answer solution, but like, you could have like a KB doc that has like, if it's not working with your theme, here are five steps that you can sort of take to try and troubleshoot it. If that's still not working, your team can like kick it back to there. You can be like, well, you know, maybe you should like run this by your web design person and they can take a look at it.
Is the challenge, right? The challenge is everything we just talked about, everything that you just talked about.
We've dealt a bit with that in audience apps too. Like, we're logging into the customer's site and publishing blog content, and sometimes like they handle their featured images in some weird way with their theme, or, you know, the content upgrades embeddable opt-in thing doesn't work with their site. And we'll try to troubleshoot it a bit, and we've got some ways to do that. But at a certain point, if their setup is so weird and not just not working, like at that point, like we could either try to do some light code investigation on their website, or we can just kick it back to them and say, hey, like, you know, we noticed this thing. It's a little bit off. Here's the behavior. Here's a screenshot. We'd recommend just running this by your web design person or your web development or your web host. And here's what you can ask them. But it's like doing them a service of like, let's make it easy. You can literally just forward our email to them and then you guys go from there.
Okay. Great in theory. What happens when they come back the next day and say, it didn't work? Can you help me? So everything you just said about making a customer engineer available is predicated on the fact that it's worth the company's time, right? You're coming to ConvertKit saying, I'm clearly worth your time. Help me out. So sounds to me like ConvertKit did the right thing. They looked and said, yeah, that's worth our time. Let's help Ryan. Our situation is, how do we tell people that they're not worth our time? It's not an okay thing. We're not okay saying that to people. And it's a genuine problem because, like I said, 50% of the support team's time is spent on this stuff. And that means not only that time and effort is wasted, but also that time and effort isn't going toward the right people. And it means that we might be overhiring, and it has all these repercussions. It's a very weird problem. You're getting too many signups, but that's not really the problem. That's like putting it in the best light possible. The real issue is we have a mismatch between who's signing up and who should be signing up.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, without getting into the weeds with it, you could just be like, well, you know, we work best with like this type of Shopify store that has this sort of setup. So you can consider migrating to that so that it'll work. But other than that,
right.
Like, you know,
right. Or something like, your tier doesn't get this level of support. So something to that effect.
Yeah. Like that's always tough to me.
It's tough. It's tough. Especially our opening tier is $300 a month.
It's tough to make the answer. Like, we help some customers, but we're not going to help you.
That's the thing. Yes. So that is a that is a genuine problem.
This is me, like a person who runs a service company and not a software company. Like the grass is always greener on the other side. One of the big, huge reasons why I'm so eager to get to focus more on software is at a certain point, it's software. It works or it doesn't work. And if it doesn't work, isn't there a line where like even there's nothing you can really do if it's not going to work? You know what I mean? Like you're not going to build them a custom version of Carthook for them.
No, it's almost like we need to empower our support team to come to that conclusion sooner. That if it's not going to work, then just say it. Just say it's not going to work because of XYZ. Here's the best way to do it. Here are the themes that work really well with our software. And here's X, Y, and Z that helps you make it work. I think the inevitable drift is toward enterprise and toward paid onboarding and toward ensuring that only people in the process are the ones that really should be in the process and are qualified from a strategic and technical and cultural fit and all that stuff. But it's definitely been a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. On audience ops, I think I might have touched on this a few weeks ago, but I do very little time and work and audience ops these days. The only thing that I do is sales. I do the sales calls, and they're basically all inbound calls at this point. And we've got a pretty automated, streamlined sales process where the customer gets educated and they see a video and they book a call and they get basically all the information up front before I even get on the call with them. And then it's like 15 minutes and then they either sign up or they don't. And I might do like a follow-up a week later that's, you know, basically canned. The question is like, when do I hire a salesperson or remove myself from that role? And it's something that I should have done a long time ago, I think. And I think I probably should do it now. I could figure out some sort of incentive package. I think that's sort of complicated considering that a lot of the leads are inbound. Although these days, like really most of the leads that I talk to, there used to be a time where many of them were coming from my audience. Now that's not the case. Some still, but like a lot of people just sign up. Like actually a really well-known company that we all know just signed up the other day. The person didn't know who I was at all. It's this thing where I'm a little bit torn because it's like, I could hire a salesperson. I could remove myself from those like 2 hours a week that I spend on it. But hiring the salesperson will cost me way more than 2 hours a week to get that process going, to find the person, to figure out what to pay them. It will cut into profit in the short term. You know, like there are all these, it just seems like a big distraction that I would rather just keep doing some of the sales calls myself because I don't hate it. You know?
And it's 2 hours a week, which is really tough to hire someone for. So it sounds to me like if I were in that situation, I would be looking at it, right? What more can they add?
I would love for them to add more too. But again, it's like, that's something totally new for me to work on getting going. And it's just not on my plate right now. So
yeah, it's an interesting problem, but it holds a lot of opportunity. If you do bring someone on that spends, let's call it 20 hours a week on sales, two of those hours are going to be a replacement for what you're doing, but the other 18 can be generating new business. And that might make it far more profitable than you doing it.
Yeah.
That would be the goal.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it's like figuring out how to find that person, what to pay them, what to look for in that type of person.
And and then to hire them and then have them change your mind a month later and then find someone else. Yeah. All the unknowns.
Yep. Anyway.
I hear you.
Well, I will see you in Vegas, buddy.
A few more days. Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. And this episode will come out after MicroConf.
Yes.
So anyone out there listening, hopefully we hung out.
Yeah. Or MicroConf starter, which I won't be at, but I'll be at the mixer thing on Tuesday night. So. All right. Have a good one, buddy.
I'll see you Sunday.